weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Thanks to David and Lottie. It's Friday, the 21st of June, and this is Game On. Alan Colley is with us to talk us through all of the evening's Euro action. After Danielle Hill's sensational swim at the European Championships yesterday, Andrew Bree joins us to discuss that gold medal win. Mark Landers and Larry O'Gorman are on hurling duty, and Neil Ewing will preview the football. If you want to get in touch, please text us on 51552. We're on X at Game On at 2FM, or you can WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome along. As always, or as all this week, we have a competition to start with. So we have some fantastic prizes to give away, thanks to Sure, the official partner of UEFA Euro 2024. So thanks to Sure, today is your last chance to win a 55-inch LG Smart TV. For a chance to win, all you've got to do is figure out which players we're talking about from the following clues. This player captained his country to the finals of the last Euros. He's the most expensive signing in Bundesliga history, and he's the all-time top goal scorer for his former club in London. So text the word SURE, your answer, your name and email address to 51552 right now, and we'll announce the winner before the end of the show. As always, RTE competition terms and conditions apply. See 2fm.ie for all the details. So we are going to get straight into the football. Every day is Euros Day, and it's been an absolutely brilliant tournament so far. Loads of goals, delivering on all fronts. And to talk us through tonight's action, what's already happened today, look ahead to tomorrow, look back on tonight as well, I'm delighted to say that Alan Colley is with us. How are you, Alan?
I'm good, Marie. How are you?
Yeah, good. Just watching a lot of football, like yourself, no doubt.
Yeah, I'm quite busy at the moment, Marie, but I'll be back into studio on Monday. I'm missing you, don't worry.
You better. So it is half-time in the 5 o'clock game. It's Poland 1, it is Austria 1. Alan, have you been watching it?
Yeah, I've been watching the game. Again, a decent game, like so many, as you said there, Marie. It's been so entertaining so far, with lots of goals, lots of exciting matches, and this is no different either. Poland, of course, suffering defeat in their first game, as did Austria. So both of them need a win. It's finely poised at the moment, 1-1 at half time. But I definitely think we'll see an exciting second half, because, as I say, both of them need to get not just the point. I feel this is a game that both of them should be targeting to take either 3 points off each other. And I definitely think we'll see that in the second half, once the two teams emerge back out on the pitch.
Fergal Brennan is with us as well. Fergal, just talking about exciting games. There was one a little bit earlier, Ukraine and Slovakia finished Ukraine 2, Slovakia 1. Again, living up to the three-goal expectation that we all want to see now. And we're getting quite a lot of those three-goal games.
We are, and it's starting to kind of separate in terms of the group stages of the teams that we probably pre-tournament expected to be the ones battling for top and second spot in each group. And Ukraine, they do have a good bit of quality, particularly in attacking areas. It's a group that I would probably say before the tournament I personally would have fancied them to get out of. It's so tight to make sure that you can get yourself into the knockouts. You probably can't afford to not win at least one game, particularly if you want to go for an automatic place. So I think Ukraine now, with that result, have probably done enough to make sure they're over the line to get into the last 16. And I think they could. I don't want to say dark horses, everyone always talks about dark horses, but I think they'll be a threat. I think they've got goals in them. I think they've got a lot of experience in important areas in the team. And I think they're effectively through now.
Yeah, it's been quite a decent start from them. Let's look at England though, Fergal, because that's really what everyone's talking about. And the, I suppose, disappointing performance against Denmark last night is probably the best way to put it. And I know the reaction has been pretty extreme, but in ways it feels almost deserved, because this was what people thought was going to happen heading into the Euros, that Gareth Southgate wouldn't be able to get the best out of his players. I know it's tournament football, and I heard Kyle Walker say that that's the way tournaments go. But when you have players the calibre that Gareth Southgate has, you just expect a little bit more flair from them.
I think you just expect a bit more of a plan, to be perfectly honest. From watching it last night, at half-time, it was a case of England didn't play great, Denmark very, very structured in the way that they play, and Hjulmand scored a brilliant goal to get them back level. But there was the anticipation, even though they weren't great against Serbia, that because of that quality that you mentioned, Bellingham, Kane, etc., that either someone would produce a moment, or just the general level that England have got would just rise up and be too much for Denmark. But particularly in the second half, they were really short on ideas. Gareth Southgate was asked about pressing and how they've worked on it in training, and he kind of didn't really have an idea. And I think it exposed this idea that putting players in certain positions because maybe there's been a bit of a drive for it doesn't necessarily work out. And it's very difficult with Trent Alexander-Arnold. I've been quite clear on this when I've been asked, either for Liverpool or for England, that I don't think moving into the middle is the right idea for him, just because he's an exceptional passer of the ball and he's got really good technique from deep areas doesn't automatically mean that he's a midfielder. I think he's played one full game for Liverpool as a central midfielder. Last season, he didn't start as a central midfielder. He would move into those areas during games. And I just think the makeup of the midfield isn't quite right. It's all fair on him that will probably fall on his shoulders because Declan Rice does a very important job and Jude Bellingham is Jude Bellingham. But I just think there was a lack of a plan on how to turn the screw on Denmark. And I also think tactically it just didn't really work. And it didn't work brilliantly against Serbia either. It was a pretty dull game. Again, one bit of kind of one-manship by Jude Bellingham got the victory for them. But yeah, I wouldn't say worrying times. I still think they'll get through and I still think there'll be a bit of a knockout stage campaign. But they're far too underprepared at this point of the tournament to be considered right amongst the best teams, in my opinion.
Alan, what do you think of your beloved Phil Foden?
Yeah, there's so many issues, Marie. I agree there just about the performance yesterday was absolutely dire. It was really poor, really bad, just in every aspect, not just in terms of in possession, out of possession as well. And there was a lack of energy and zest about them. And they almost look unrecognisable from the players we see week to week in the Premier League. And it's on Southgate, really, because he has to get the best out of this group of players. Fergal mentioned the lack of a plan, and that's almost what it looked like. There was a few comments afterwards with Kane touching on them pressing and not knowing the triggers, when to press. Like Southgate, they've been preparing for this tournament for 2 years, and it was almost the case of because of the individuals that they have and that individual quality that you just throw them all in together and it'll be a moment of magic from somewhere and someone will come up with a wonder goal or a piece of magic to create a chance or whatever. But football doesn't work like that, Marie. And that's why you see the best coaches managing the best teams in the world and the structure. And what highlighted it for me really yesterday, I'll come to Arnold in a minute because I played midfield. And if people think you can just automatically become a centre midfielder, having been a right full all your life, it just doesn't happen, particularly at international level. But you look at John Stones and building up from Man City and the clear and concise structure that they have with Rodri or Kovacic in front of them and how they make it look easy. It's not easy, but they make it look easy because of obviously how structurally they're set up and John Stones, how comfortable he is coming out with the ball. Yesterday, coming out with the ball, he looked like a lad who had never even seen these players before that he was playing alongside. Like, and that's only the starting point where you're trying to build the attack. Rice can't receive the ball on the half turn as the number six. They've moved Trent in there to obviously feel as though he's the one that's going to be our passer and playmaker. But he only comes into midfield, Marie, in a team with Liverpool when they're dominating possession and 80-90% of the games that will dominate the games in the Premier League, and he's wandering into spaces that frees him up. But in international football, if you start as a centre midfielder, did they not realise that Denmark have centre midfielders as well that are going to close you down and get tight to you and get in around you and in amongst you? But Trent almost felt like as if no one can come near him, and he has this licence that he should receive the ball and be able to zing balls 50, 60, 70 yards. Like, it's unbelievable, to some of the stuff that I was watching yesterday. It was horrendous. And when you look at Germany and what we've seen in the structure, and he has similar issues, Nagelsmann, in terms of how do I fit the talent in, but he has a lovely balance to that with Gundogan, Wirtz to the right, who you could say is the equivalent of a Foden, and he has Musiala, who's the equivalent to a Bellingham, maybe just off the side of Gundogan, and of Havertz through the middle. So he's been able to get a system in place there. Nagelsmann, a top coach, and Southgate has major issues because looking at England yesterday, they're going nowhere fast.
Yeah, I don't think there's too many that would disagree with you, Al. Fergal, just one thing that I just find so curious. When you look at this England team and they take an early lead and you expect that they're going to settle down and that the nerves would dissipate and that they would use it as a platform to build on. But instead, when they seem to score early enough, it's the opposite effect, that they almost get more conservative, that they don't have enough energy, that they're lethargic. They just don't seem to push on from that. How worrying is that?
I think for England fans it will be worrying, particularly those of whom who started the tournament thinking that they were amongst the favourites, potentially going on to win it. But I think it comes back to the P word, plan. Mm. Every as Alan correctly said there, every top coach in the world has a playbook for all these different scenarios. And England going front, there should be a play for, right, how do we get from the 20-minute mark when we're in front to half-time and then change and evolve that at half-time if the opposition have improved or you've improved. And then second up, there should be constant in-game management. I'm not saying maybe necessarily Pep Guardiola levels of substitutions and changes, but there has to be a couple of different things to go, right, when we're in this situation, this is what we do. And the manager should know that and the players should know that. And I listened to the Harry Kane interview last night, and it's, I don't think it sounds good that he's, I wouldn't say he's calling out the situation, but Harry Kane's an incredibly experienced individual. He knows the power of his words in a public interview after a game, and that was a little bit a tense watch of England fans were looking at that, because this is the situation. They go in front, and then it's a case of you have some supporters saying, go for the kill, get the second goal, get the third goal, kill the game, done, dusted. Southgate isn't going to do that. So you go, okay, he is a bit more naturally conservative, but there's got to be something. You can still be conservative and push for a second goal against a team that you should beat relatively comfortably. I refer that a bit more to Serbia than Denmark. That just doesn't seem to be the case. It seems to be get in front, okay, we don't really know what's happening here, and then invite on a load of pressure, hang on, and then clap if you get a 1-0 or a 2-0 win. And that's just not the way international football works. You've got to know when to push, when to go for the throat, when to stand off, when to change things up. Players should know that, and the players have to carry a bit of this themselves. I do agree with Alan that a big majority of this is on Gareth Southgate, but these are players playing for the best clubs in the Premier League, some of the best clubs in Europe. They know how to manage games. They work with elite players every day, elite level coaches. Nobody really seems to either be willing to take that bit of responsibility or able to take that bit of responsibility.
Alan, just on the substitutes then that Gareth Southgate made. So Eze, Saka, Bowen came on, Foden, Watkins and Harry Kane off. Do you think that they made much of an impact?
Not really, Marie, because I suppose that's what you're looking for from the substitutes, is to make that impact. And he has a plethora to choose from, really. I suppose the criticism that he's facing now is, why not Cole Palmer or why not Anthony Gordon? Now, I would have actually been shouting for Anthony Gordon to start matches, never mind coming off the bench. Again, to make the balance of the team much better if you play two number eights with Foden and Bellingham, Rice sitting. Obviously there's no Trent then, so you have Anthony Gordon wide on the left and you have Saka wide and right and Kane through the middle. And that's something what I'm saying to you about, you were talking there about having the lack of a plan. Your personnel dictates your plan as well, what the options that you have. What I found the most damning thing as well, Marie, yesterday, and I thought, I couldn't believe he actually came out with it, Southgate. He says we've no like for like for Calvin Phillips. Like, that is the most damning thing for him. When you think of the talent he has at his disposal and he's referring back to, we don't have Calvin Phillips, how much the other players must feel in the squad. I'd say Trent, he's becoming the scapegoat, but I'd say he's absolutely disgusted to hear comments like that. You have Kobbie Mainoo, you have Wharton. I know they're young and experienced players, but they're centre and midfield players. Play one of them. For him to come out and say we've no Calvin Phillips when he has some of the best players in the world at his disposal, like, I honestly, that would worry me. For me, that would, if I was an England fan, that would worry me when the manager is coming out with statements like that. So in terms of the substitutes, I think he could have picked anyone yesterday because nobody was playing well. He chose Eze to come on, Watkins. I've no problem with that. Watkins actually ran in behind, something that was missing. And some of the criticism around Kane as well, I do get it a little bit, but I think it's a bit harsh also. People need to realise when Kane does drop in, he always has runners beyond him. The problem that we're having yesterday, Marie, when he was dropping in, there is no runners. They don't have a Sterling or a Rashford. Foden's coming to feed because he wants it to feed. Saka was the only one who was the outlet. I was surprised he took him off, and he's been the outlet in the two games and he was taken off. So some of the decisions at the moment, I just don't get. And I suppose these were the question marks around Southgate that's been there for a long time. Everybody was talking them up beforehand because of the individuals. But it always came back to that criticism of, will Southgate get the best out of them? And what we're seeing at the moment, Marie, it's horrendous. And not only what we're seeing on the pitch is horrendous, but also the comments after match. And that one in particular about Calvin Phillips is the most damning of them all for me.
Fergal, the one thing that really bothered me watching them last night was just that lack of intensity out of possession. So when you think of, I guess, the athletes that they have as well as footballers, that they weren't really putting Denmark under a huge amount of pressure in their build-up. And it was just like they could get up the pitch with ease.
Yeah, but again, that comes back to structures in terms of what are they working on in training, what's been the background work that's been done on Denmark. I just feel that it all kind of feeds into the same wider point. And the Calvin Phillips comment was a strange one, but I think that's more associated with how you view Calvin Phillips and obviously his club career now, etc. But it is true in a way that England don't have a player that's just incredibly selfless, that will just sit in there, be a body, keep things ticking along against Declan Rice. When him and Declan Rice played together at Euro 2020, they were really, really effective. Not the most exciting, not the most progressive, but they effectively were able to say to the four players in front of them, go and win the game. Go win the game and we'll just be here. That's not the case now. You've got a situation where gaps are appearing, there's a lack of structure, there's a lack of positioning. Trent Alexander-Arnold, again, unfortunately, we go back to him. He doesn't quite know where he should be, in or out of possession. I agree with what Alan said a minute ago. He kind of wants to exist in this situation where there's almost a ring around him and he can just play the balls that he wants and do what he wants. Jude Bellingham's a brilliant player, but he's been asked to play in a role that he's not completely comfortable with when you look at how he operates for Real Madrid. I just think the only player that's probably playing their natural club game in that midfield and attack is Bukayo Saka. Mm-hmm. He's been pretty good, in my opinion, so far in the competition.
But the point that you make about the ring around you, I agree. And you'll notice yourself in training, and you'll know, Marie, when you play five-a-sides or you might have 11 players, you'll play with a floater. He actually reminds me, Trent, that he wants to be the floater. He only wants to play when he has the ball. He has no interest. And even in terms of defensively, again, Southgate should notice this and see this. And that's where it brings me on. The next point actually brings me on to Rice, because he's getting a lot of stick today. But I actually felt Rice was almost trying to babysit him and rather concentrate on his own game. He spent so much time trying to worry about where Trent was, whereas Fergal says when he had that relationship with Phillips, both of them knew their roles, they had an understanding and a partnership with them, a relationship built up, that he could concentrate on his own game without worrying where Phillips was. Whereas yesterday, I'm looking at Declan Rice, and every time they were on the attack, Denmark, or when they were building up, he's almost looking to see is Trent in the right position without actually worrying about what he's doing himself, and it just took away from his game. Now, he was very poor as well in possession. I don't think it's his game receiving the ball off the back four and trying to build up. That's why you have Jorginho doing it at Arsenal maybe, and Arteta has noticed that and has pushed him on. But for Southgate to say it was an experiment, you experiment in friendlies, you don't experiment in the championship matches, Marie, because yesterday could have gone really wrong for them yesterday as well. Denmark completely outplayed them. Now, they're lucky enough that they have 4 points on the board, and he can go back to that and say, look, it's tournament football and a lot of negativity and we're building and all this. But to me, the experiments need to happen for the last 2 years when you're building up in the tournament, when they're rolling over teams in the qualifiers. That's when you experiment, not when you're in the cut and thrust of the championship. And as I said, Germany look ready to rock. France look ready to rock. Spain are ready to rock. And England at the moment are going home wondering, where are we going from here?
Are we giving Denmark any credit? Should we be giving Denmark any credit, Fergal?
Because I think they performed as they were probably anticipated to do, which is that they do know what's expected of them. Individually, collectively, they know exactly where they should be, what they should be doing, when, why, how, etc. And they do have quality. Christian Eriksen, despite the fact he hasn't played a huge amount at Manchester United last season, is still such a good footballer. He's still so clever in the spaces that he takes up, in the way that he receives the ball. He's calm. Jonas Vind, I thought, was very good in attack for Denmark last night. And Martin Hulmand, again, we come back. I think that's probably a neat way to kind of wrap it up. He was playing as a defensive midfielder for Denmark last night. Had a really complete game in his defensive side, and he popped up with an unbelievable goal. That doesn't happen, I don't think. Trent Alexander-Arnold can do that. Even Declan Rice can bang one in from distance every now and again. None of England's midfield players looked like they were going to do that last night. And that's, again, the issue. I do fundamentally think that this idea of this structure of the midfield and the attack, I don't think it's a last-minute thing, but I honestly think it was cooked up in the training camp going into this tournament. And to back up what Alan said, that's way too late.
Yeah, you can see that. Al, just before we move on from England last night, what did you think of James McLean's comments about Declan Rice, that he's a good footballer but he's not world class?
Yeah, look, James is entitled to his opinion, Marie. I think Declan Rice is a very good player. Just because he said it might make a headline, but Declan Rice is an excellent player and he's proved that at Arsenal. I don't think he'd be too concerned about those comments, to be honest.
Fergal, has it caught the attention over your way?
To an extent, yeah. But more in this idea that Declan Rice is a player that, that England fans will defend, Arsenal fans as well. I agree to the extent that I still think there's work to be done to be considered as world class. I think he's an excellent player, but is he one of the top two or three number sixes in the world? No, he's not. He might become that, mm-hmm. but at the moment, the body of evidence would say not quite work to do. And it has caused a bit of a wave. Obviously, James McLean's a well-known face, shall we say. And I think there was clearly a bit of sauce that he was drizzling on that one as he was saying it. But I do think there's a point in there. Is he at the absolute top of his game? Is he one of the very best number sixes in world football? No. And that's kind of the core of James's point.
Yeah. OK, let's move on to tonight's one. Netherlands and France, a big game in determining the group winner. We know France, Alan, they don't often start maybe at full tilt, but they're really good at growing into competitions. Do you think the Netherlands are going to test them tonight?
I think the Wilmery, to be fair, I covered the Netherlands at the weekend and I was quite impressed with them. I know they went to goal behind and conceded a set-piece goal, which to be disappointed with because defensively, even coming into the tournament, they had six clean sheets out of the last seven games. So they're rock solid at the back. And when you think there was no De Ligt, no Van de Ven, it just goes to show the quality that they have at the back. And even in forward areas as well, I thought Cody Gakpo was unbelievable the first half. Played really, really well. He ended up getting man of the match. He didn't quite have the same impact in the second half, but he was very, very good in the first half. I think he has a decision to make. Obviously, Memphis Depay didn't have the impact. Veghorst came on, scored, but you could argue he is that impact sub. Starting games, maybe not for Veghorst. So I think Koeman might just stick with that for the moment. The issue for them is there's no De Jong and there's no Koopmeiners at the moment, and there won't be either in the tournament. And in the midfield area, they just looked a little bit short. They played the two lads from PSV, and Veerman in particular, he struggled. Pep Reinders is the other one from AC Milan. And I just think they're a little bit short in that midfield area. In attacking areas, I was impressed with them, and defensively. So I do think they'll trouble France. But France, to be fair, had a tough game against Austria. I thought Austria were very, very good, Marie, and put them under a lot of pressure. But they did. They got the goal and they managed the game quite well. Of course, all eyes are on Mbappe and how soon they can get him back and the impact it will have on the team. But they do have an unbelievable array of talent. And even in those forward areas, you'd expect maybe the likes of Barcola to come in on that wide left position instead of Mbappe tonight. So it'll be interesting to see. I do think they'll trouble them, but I still think France are a bit above the Netherlands at the moment.
Fergal, what's your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I'd agree. I think France will edge it. Obviously, the Mbappe story is the big one that's attracting all the attention. But I think they were quite good against Austria the other night. They obviously got a big bit of luck to get the win and the own goal. But I think they've got the best ability to just tear teams apart in this tournament. I still think Germany, they're my guys that I'm backing to win it, and they're the most complete and rounded. But even without Mbappe, I don't think there's another team that has the ability to say, in transition, when we're breaking on you, you cannot live with us. And I do think that the Dutch, particularly through the middle of the pitch, they can be a bit slow in their build-up. If there's a quick turnover of ball and someone loses out and they're able to burst forward, I just think France, I think if they get on a bit of a roll, a couple of chances could have gone in against Austria the other night. Obviously, Mbappe missed one himself. I think if they get on a roll, they'll start flying because they've got so many goals, they've got so much pace, and they're still a brilliant team.
Al, can you multitask? Are you watching Austria and Poland?
I'm not, Marie. Sorry, no.
Right,
I'm not.
Austria have gone ahead now.
I'm giving you my full attention here, Marie. I wouldn't do that.
You're rare now, to be fair. So they've just scored now, 66th minute. It's Austria 2, Poland 1. Another very entertaining game. I mean, I have been listening to you. I haven't just been watching this game. I'm being honest here. Okay, guys, thank you so much. So, Al, is your favourite still Portugal, or have you veered off a little bit?
Well, we've had this conversation, Marie. I don't veer away once I pick one. So I went for Portugal at the start. Obviously, they made heavy weather of the game the other night, but they got the win. Again, my issue at the start, and I said this to you, was Martinez, and he's a bit like Southgate at the moment with the talent that they have. Can he fit them all in? It was a bit disjointed at times. By the end of the game, I know they were chasing the game, but by the end of it, there was players everywhere and there was no shape to the team whatsoever. And it was harem-scarem stuff, but So far, the team I'd be most impressed with have been Germany because of the balance in the team. They look well coached, well drilled, all organised. They're fitting the individuals in where they need to be, and they're playing as a team, most importantly. So I'd have, even though I tipped Portugal, I'd have question marks over Martinez. England can forget about it. I've ruled them out. They're gone. Spain have been very good as well. I know Italy weren't up to much, but Spain have been probably the second most impressive team that I've seen.
Okay, thanks so much, lads. We'll be talking to you again next week. We're going to take a very quick break, but do stay with us. We'll be talking to Andrew Bree about the European Swimming Championships. We've also got Gaelic football with Neil Ewing to come after these.
2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. We're going to turn our attention to swimming. I'm delighted to say that Andrew Bree is with me on the line. How are you, Andrew?
I'm good, Marie. How are you? All good. You're probably live streaming something in the background for yourself. I'm live streaming the swimming here. It's still going on, so we're all multitasking.
Yeah, I've one eye on Austria-Poland, but delighted to hear that you're watching the swimming as well. Actually, do you know what, Andrew? Every time I speak to you, Ireland seem to be winning medals, so there we go.
What's that all about? I know. We connect for the audience when we're winning. It's great. No, it's going to be a great summer. Look, we've 5 weeks until the opening ceremony in Paris. These swimmers are stepping up. It's great to see. As before, when we talked, it's great to see these swimmers race. Every time they race, they learn something new. So we're getting into finals. It's huge. It's huge for some of those younger swimmers as well to get onto that international stage and demonstrate really perfected race strategy. It's impressive.
Yeah, it really is. And let's talk about Danielle Hill winning the golds last night at the European Swimming Championships that you're watching right now in Serbia. So she was actually on the brink of giving up competitive swimming less than a year ago, and then she wins the 50 metre backstroke at the European Championships. That's quite a turnaround from Danielle, and so impressive and delighted for her, clearly, as she had maybe thought that it wasn't for her, and then she goes off and does great things. Tell us a little bit about Danielle, Andrew.
Well, I think, you know, once you meet Danielle, you'll understand the I'm even getting goosebumps talking about her. She's an absolute warrior. She is so strong mentally. She did have that lapse, but it's almost like the great narrative of the hero's journey, where you're defeated, but you have to go through the lowest point, the belly of the beast, in order to, you know, reclaim what she's destined to do. That's when so impressive to be on this stage, to be knocking out. She's qualified second fastest for tomorrow night's final as well for the 100 meter backstroke. So when you meet Danielle, she is a very independent, she is very strong willed. Her and her coach have got such a beautiful synchronized, whatever you want to call it, teamwork within their stable in Lauren Swimming Club. It works together. Now, he's Peter Hill, not related, but how crazy is that? Both Hills. But she trains in a very small kind of 5-lane, 25 meter pool, hardly any windows. They have to open the door to get the kind of better ventilation. And she just steps up, and she's just a beautiful technician of the sport. She's such a beacon, such an inspiration. She's great with the younger swimmers. She helps out with the club. She was down, I was commentating at the Ulster Masters, and she was there with a group of adults helping them out. And she's just so passionate. And it's great to see, after that almost difficult time in her life, she's used that to build and use that as she's transmuted that energy into something positive. And I think we can all learn from it.
Yeah, it's brilliant. So Ireland's first European long course champion in 27 years. That's quite an achievement as well. Why is it taking so long for us to have a long course champion?
Yeah, well, we could go into how long did you have?
We'll see if there's until the next goal.
I finished up swimming 2012. That was my last year. And then I've been involved with, you know, coaching on all levels, age group, with the National Performance Centre, and then individual stuff in terms of technique. And it comes down to technique. It really comes down to technique. And Swim Ireland are now building. We're getting there. We're always getting there. I always think there's never an end point for any organization, you know, but we're getting there in terms of putting the right things in places. But the right things in places have to involve the club coaching, and the club coaching have to have the ability to look at these technical things. Even at swimmers, I work with some swimmers 21, 22 that are national level swimmers, and they're still doing some really kind of basic head position, not catching the water. So I'm a big believer that if we can get the platform correct, get the right procedures in place with the club coaches, and then a collaboration. It's never just one system and then the club coaching. It has to be a future collaboration where we're learning, and the events, the display of swimming from these swimmers at this championships have now inspired club coaching, have inspired the younger generation. But big technical stuff, I think, is the number one thing. But that's all. It's just, again, we're all on a journey, not only one individual swimmer, but as Swim Ireland's on a journey, everyone's on a journey. And it's great momentum, even with our sport coming into the summer. I'm really looking forward to Paris.
Yeah, same. And just some breaking news as well. Claire Crine has won a brilliant bronze in the 3 metre springboard at the European Championships as well. So we have another star there, Claire. So
there we go. I think we just keep talking. More medals just keep popping up.
Yeah, so that's amazing. And again, it's not something that we medal at all the time, I'd imagine, Andrew.
No, but you see, the journey is, it's not only the journey to get onto that podium on the day of the race, the pressure, the mindset, the preparation, the focus, everything. It's not that day. It's like every day for years and years and years. So that's why when the right things are in place and you're surrounded by the right teammates, some people love to swim in the national centres with, higher level athletes. Some people like to swim in club teams. It's wherever the swimmer feels they're going to get their best ability. What works with the coach, so it's fantastic. And if we can keep this momentum, like I said earlier, there's so many young swimmers coming through, Ellie McCartney, Owen Corby. They're all now tapping into these finals. And I remember when I swam and made a European final, it gives you such a boost. You start believing, okay, now I'm in the realm of these top class swimmers around the world. So let's go. And then the next step obviously is Olympics. And then the next step, that's the highest step, the highest mountain, yeah. Mount Olympus.
So Conor Ferguson is in action in the 50-metre backstroke final at 6:54. Nathan Whiffen is straight through to the final of the men's 1500-metre freestyle. That's going to be on tomorrow. How do you think Nathan's going to do?
Nathan's good. I watched his 800 last night, live streamed it. And again, a few technical things. I think he can mix up his his lead line, getting technical here. We don't need that. But look, he's looking good. He just needs to get into it. Look, his brother Daniel has obviously dominated the distance scene for a while. Nathan is just as good. They train in the same place, Loughborough University over in England. They race each other every day. What a competitive spirit to have, not only a teammate, but your twin brother, like facing you. It's like man in the mirror type stuff if you're racing every day. They're going to be good. I think he's only really stepping into his international kind of swimming. Daniel's made that leap. I think Nathan's next. And then, like you said, we'll get Danielle Hill tomorrow night. Who else did you mention there?
Conor Ferguson, a little bit
Conor
later
Ferguson,
on.
Conor Ferguson, what a story. What a story. Conor Ferguson just missed the Olympics in 2016 by 0.05. Missed it for Tokyo by 0.1. Just missed it there recently, three times going for it, just missed it. Now he's flying in the Europeans. And look, I'm not saying anything. There might be something, hopefully, down the line. There could be some different relay options that might happen for the Olympics. So fingers crossed things can work out maybe, but it's all up to the Olympic Federation of Ireland, and that's all up to the higher swimming gods, I call them. But Ferguson is a great guy. What a warrior, just like Danielle from the Lauren team. He's over in Loughborough. But really committed, loves his swimming, absolutely loves his swimming, and he just loves the mindset part of it. And he's not the tallest backstroker in the world. If you look at those guys he's against, a lot of them are 6'3", up to 6'6". Connor's coming in at 5-something, but he has got a bite in that dog. He is a fighter. So it's great to see him in a couple of finals this week.
Okay, sounds good. Lots to look forward to. And as you said, the Paris Olympics are just around the corner as well. So it does bode well for what's coming down the track. Andrew, thank you so much. And looking forward to chatting.
You're very
to you
welcome.
Again. And since you've the swimming on, I might as well let people know that Austria have scored another goal. We timed it absolutely perfect. I said we have up until the next goal. It's now Austria 3 and Poland 1. Andrew, we'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
Thanks
all
so
the best.
Much.
Thank you.
We're going to turn our attention now to Gaelic football. Neil Ewing joins me on the line. How are you, Neil?
Hey, Marie. How are things? How are you?
Good. Looking forward to this weekend in the Gaelic Football Championship. It does feel like it's really getting going now. And by the end of it, there will be less teams in it. We'll have a good idea of where everybody is at, but still some mouthwatering encounters to come over the next couple of days. It doesn't really get bigger, though, Neil, than Mayo and Derry. A lot of people think this is well set up for Derry, but could you look at it both ways and say that it's set up well for Mayo as well?
Possibly you could, given the form that Derry have shown since the championship started. But then you have to consider they were Division 1 champions as well. So I think it's a form issue with Derry rather than a class issue. And that's why I just think it really is a banana skin for Mayo. Mayo were they were excellent last week. I think they probably played close to their max in drawing with Dublin. They were very, very impressive. But Derry can only improve on what they've shown since the championship kicked off. And there's a lot of room for improvement on their win against Westmeath last week. But I think they have it in them to improve. And Mayo coming off the high of that Dublin game. Derry with, I guess, zero expectations heading down to Castlebar. It's just set up for an ambush. If they can start well, I think with Derry, you know, people have talked about tiredness and physical issues like that. But I think it's been psychological as much as anything. Belief in their system, belief in themselves was just shattered by the kick-out malfunction against Donegal. If they can start well tomorrow on the back of a win last week, Mayo support are going to get a little frustrated. And then there's an opportunity there for Derry. And if they were to get a win, they're the team that...
Oh, we've got you back, Neil. We lost you there for a second. Yep, we lost you for a second, but you're back to us again. Just while we're on the topic of Mayo and Derry and I guess maybe the fortunes of them to date, will it be difficult for Mayo to, I guess, get up to the levels that they need to emotionally again in such a short space of time?
I don't think so, Marie. On St Patrick's Day, Derry went down to Castlebar and they beat Mayo quite comfortably. They were pretty impressive that day, and they were, I guess, that performance in Castlebar showed that Derry were All Ireland contenders, and it probably showed Mayo that they weren't. And that Mayo team, you know, they themselves would like to see themselves as All Ireland contenders. So I think, even from that league game in Castlebar, they'll have a point to prove from that. And I think they've just taken a little too much abuse from their own supporters over the last few months as well in terms of their performances. So I think Mayo look like a team with a chip on their shoulder. They'll have taken a lot from that performance against Dublin. You know, it's not so long ago people were talking about Dublin as being untouchable. Mayo were really impressive. How they set up tactically, it really worked for them. And there's a lot to be said for the belief that a group of players, and this is a new Mayo team, and I think people forget that. So the belief that a new Mayo team are going to get from that performance in Hyde Park last week is going to be brilliant for them. And I don't see them going into this game underestimating Derry in any way.
You could probably say the same about Tyrone and that win over Cork as well, and how much confidence they're going to take into this game against Roscommon, Healy Park, 5 o'clock. How do you see this going?
Tyrone are just a team I've struggled to understand since their All-Ireland win. There's so much talent there. And, you know, even with RTE coverage of the club championships the last few winters, you see some club games from Tyrone, and the talent of footballers in Tyrone is just incredible. You know, I think it's probably one of the highest standards club championship, probably helped by the fact that a straight knockout, maybe it's more drama than high standard, but there is so many footballers in Tyrone. We've seen their underage teams in recent years. I've seen their schools teams in Hogan Cup finals the last 2 years, and it's just incredible to conveyor about the talent they have. But at senior, they've just been inconsistent. They're capable of beating the best teams, but then they're capable of losing to a middle-ranked team. And Roscommon are just one of those type of teams that they've struggled with. And Roscommon last weekend, we've seen they can be free-scoring. I think Tyrone probably just need to... set up similarly to how they did against Donegal in the Ulster Championship, quite conservatively. And it might, you know, even Tyrone support might feel it's beneath them to set up conservatively initially against Roscommon. But I think, you know, just shore it up at the back initially. And I think it's probably close to impossible for any team to keep Dara Canavan quiet for 70 minutes. So I think a steady start by Tyrone and build into it in the second half. They have lots of legs in their team. Some of these young guys coming in from the under-20s, even Seanie O'Donnell there around the middle of the pitch. He reminds me a lot of Ryan McHugh. He's just all legs. He can pop up anywhere. Probably going to get more goal chances in a game than point opportunities. But yeah, they just need to maybe grind Roscommon down initially and then just get the ball into Dara Canavan's hands so we can all enjoy watching them.
Yeah, wouldn't that be lovely? Galway and Monaghan. And Monaghan are such a funny one because every year they seem to do something spectacular. They take a big scalp, they come away with something unexpected, whether it's survival in Division 1 or whatever. Do you think this will be the day that we think, oh, right, they're Monaghan, up to their old tricks again?
Well, yeah, not a year goes by that they don't pull off one of them games. And I know they beat Dublin in the first league game this year. I hope they haven't got it in reverse and started winning the big games at the start of the year. Listen, they're a team that's, it's a cliche, but they are a team that's in transition. But you do always have that expectation that they can pull something out of the bag. And again, that's because there's good footballers in Monaghan. You know, Conor McManus is obviously still there. If they can, you know, stay in that game with Galway, the weather this week, it's been terrible. And if it's been terrible anywhere in Ireland, it's been worse in Salt Hill. Hopefully, I think it's meant to be a little bit better for the weekend. But even with that, there's always a wind in Salt Hill. You know, if Monaghan can maybe play into a win in the first half, just keep within touching distance of Galway, and then, you know, get Conor McManus on, use his shooting ability from long range. You know, they always have a chance. Ryan O'Toole went off injured last week, you know, to a squad that's taken a few injury hits. That is not ideal. Listen, Monaghan need everything to go well for them, but Vinnie Corey has shown that he can set them up for specific games like this to probably play above their potential. For Galway, it's probably more so than Mayo versus Derry. For Galway, this is one that could be tricky to get up for. You know, with 30 seconds to go in the game last week, they were already in a quarter-final. Then 6 days later, they find themselves having to play Monaghan. There's probably not going to be a huge crowd at the game. You know, Monaghan aren't going to bring a big travelling support. A lot of Galway supporters probably going to think, well, I'll hold on, wait and see will they win tomorrow and go to Croke Park the week after. So there is going to be just a lag or a dullness to the preparations, I think, around Galway. But Galway just need to get as many of their best players on the pitch as possible. And I do feel sorry for them because they've just been crippled with injuries probably for the last 2 years. And they went from a stage where they played an All-Ireland final 2 years ago and they were back as contenders to falling back into the bunch a little bit. You'd like to see them go out tomorrow, statement performance, you know, build into the quarterfinal with a bit of momentum after last week, the momentum stalling. The worry for Galway is that quarterfinal draw. You know, do they pull out a Dublin or a Kerry? That's going to be a tough one if they have to face into that 6-7 days after this game tomorrow.
Louth versus Cork then seems to be the one that people are struggling to call, could end up being the tightest game. What do you reckon?
Yeah, and you know, it may actually turn out that it's the best game to watch of the weekend and the one that maybe the least amount of people will tune in to watch. But listen, there are two teams that they've probably had contrasting seasons in that Loud, you know, started the league well and kind of maintained that right through. Cork started the league very poorly and they've built... There's a lot of talent on both sides. You know, you have to admire what Loud are doing. I think especially under new management, Joe Brennan's came in. You know, Mickey Hart and Gavin Devlin had done a lot of good work in Loud, and he hasn't thrown any of that out, but he's tried to add little chinks to it. Cork, likewise, they're two teams, stylistically, they're not a million miles apart. You can imagine it being a running game. Craig Lennon in the half-back line for Loud, he just gets up and down the pitch relentlessly. And Matty Taylor for Cork is pretty much a carbon copy, and they're great players to watch. And with that, their running styles, those two wing-backs, again, end up in goal-scoring positions more often than point-scoring positions. They've played... last 2 years, and it seems to be that anytime they play in RD, Loud have the upper hand. They played in the championship in Navan last year, Cork had the upper hand. So when they play in the Skene in Monaghan this year, it's going to be a tight game. But I don't know, I just maybe the impact from Cork off the bench. Brian Hurley is down to start, Stephen Sherlock is on the bench, and Stephen Sherlock is going to start for, I would say, 80%, 90% of teams in the country. He's a scoring forward that maybe Loud don't have a comparable to bring on.
Very quickly then, Neil, just a word on the two Tailteann Cup semi-finals. Who do you imagine will progress from them?
Yeah, the Tailteann Cup semi-finals, obviously the highlight of the weekend. Make sure to remind all the hurling people about that.
Careful now.
Despite their suggestions otherwise. No, I think we could have found time to promote both hurling and football, but it is what it is this weekend. Sligo versus Down. Listen, Down are probably the team that should win the Tailteann Cup. They played Sligo in the league and they gave them a pretty decent beating up in Newry. Mm-hmm. But I think Sligo are improving. just the problem for Sligo over the last few weeks has been to get a game that would show, give a true barometer of how much they have improved by, and that's what this game on Sunday will be. Down are exactly the team that Sligo want to be next year, promoted from Division 3, looking forward to a season in Division 2. The worry I have for Down is lots of talent, loads of really exciting footballers across the pitch, but they've just struggled to get up for games where they've been the favourite. And it nearly feels like after them winning Division 3 and expecting to play Sam Maguire, that, I don't know, maybe subconsciously it feels like the Talton Cup is below them. So, you know, if they're anyway sluggish in how they start on Sunday, Sligo are a team full of legs, full of running, similar to Down, and they will relish the opportunity of getting out in Croke Park.
Right, and Laois and Antrim then is the other one. In a word, who will win that one? Oh, we've lost Neil. So, Neil, you gone? Right, well, we're going to have to...
I think Antrim.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Yeah, sorry, issue with the sound there.
No worries.
Thanks very much.
We'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much, Neil. We're going to take a very quick break, but do stay with us. We'll be previewing those All-Ireland Hurling quarterfinals after this.
RTE 2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. Before we get into the hurling, I want to announce the competition winner, that fantastic prize of a 55-inch LG Smart TV, thanks to Shure, the official partner of UEFA Euro 2024. And the winner is Emer O'Reilly from Kilkenny, and she got the correct answer, and that was Harry Kane. So congratulations to you, Emer. Now it is time to chat hurling, and I am delighted to say that we are joined by Larry O'Gorman and Mark Landers, two absolutely huge games of hurling to come. We're going to start with Clare and Wexford, though, and I'm going to go to you first, Larry. Just given the magnitude of the weekend, it's almost hard to believe we're at this stage of the championship, but we absolutely are. And I've been listening to a lot of people talking about this game, Larry, and lots of people are suggesting that Wexford are going to win it, that it's going to be, well, it's not really an upset because they're two evenly enough match teams. What do you think, Larry?
Yeah, well, you know, it's there for the taking now, one would say. You know, people are asking the questions now, have Clare left empty the tank over the last number of weeks in their games, and are Wexford getting fresher as the year is going on? So, to be quite honest, it's going to be very close. I know Clare will certainly be hurt over losing the Munster final and, you know, staying in the game for a long time, missing quite a lot of chances, which is unusual. It's unlikely, it's unlike Clare to do that. So, but from a Wexford point of view, yeah, I think we're hurling nicely. I think we're getting better with every game, even though last day against Laois didn't really bring us on much. But what it did do, it gave a couple of guys an extra run, a bit more playing time. And, you know, we have some of the under-21s that Keith would have been involved with for the last number of years now have stood up to the plate, and they're getting on quite well with the likes of Lee and Rory O'Connor and Matthew Allen and these guys. So, yeah, I think there's a bit of fight left in Wexford, you know, but tomorrow will tell the, you know, tell the story. You know, we'll know from the start to throw in how keyed up and how fired up we are for the game. But Clare will be a bit hurted over the last couple of games, and, you know, they'll want to show their true colours. So we're expecting a ding-dong battle, but I think Wexford are going to be up for the battle, and it's our last hurrah, and it's going to be Clare's last hurrah. But to be quite honest, Marie, if you look back at last year, you know, we were nearly thrown into the Joe McDonagh, and this year now we're in the All-Ireland quarterfinals. So it just goes to show you that there's a lot of potential in Wexford, and we're improving as the year goes on as well. So hopefully tomorrow now we create another upset and look forward to an All-Ireland semi-final.
Yeah, not a bad place to be at all. Mark, what do you think Clare need to do to improve on that Munster final defeat?
I'd say they'd need to, I'd say, get their heads back in the game, to be honest with them, Marie. As Larry has mentioned, you know, the last three performances against Waterford and Limerick and Tipperary in the latter stages of the round robin were very poor in comparison to what we saw earlier in the season where they were national hurling champions. They were playing with a lot of fluidity. I suppose the one difference is that Tony Kelly wasn't involved at the start of the season. He's now be coming on, and he started the last day, and they just don't seem to have their mojo back, to be honest. I do think that we'll see a bounce from Clare this weekend. I know after the Munster final, they took a week off. They didn't take any training. And sometimes, as well, when you get to this stage of the season and they've had a long season, that, you know, less is more in their scenario. I think if they, you know, for them to win on Sunday, they need a big performance from their six forwards. They particularly, I suppose, need David Fitzgerald has been hurling very well. Duggan on the other wing has been outstanding under the dropping ball. And in Shane O'Donnell, they have a really, really good player. And the big question for Wexford, I suppose, is I don't know whether Liam Ryan is going to be fit to play. Young Conor Foley has been outstanding for Wexford this season, but he's only a young lad. And Shane O'Donnell is one of the most experienced forwards around. So for me, those three key players for Clare, if they turn up and play well, I think they'll give a great account to themselves.
Larry, do you think that Dublin are going to be able to bounce back from their Leinster final defeat and show up against Cork?
Yeah, well, I think they will bounce back, but I don't think there'll be enough bounce in them to beat Cork, to be quite honest. You know, they're fairly game, they're fairly hurt over the Leinster final performance, but I seen Cork play Wexford in the National League in Wexford Park, and I thought they were superb. You know, I said it all along that Cork would be my favourite team, a fancy team, to go on to win the All-Ireland, just on the performance of Wexford Park, because the speed and the strength of them, whatever, the whole lot, just sort of blew most of us out of it. But from a Dublin point of view, yes, they sort of know to let themselves down in the Leinster final. They're well capable of hurling very well on a big occasion. So this is a big occasion for Dublin, but I think it's bigger for Cork. So I think Cork will have the upper hand. Sorry, I won't say might, will have the upper hand, because Dublin themselves can nearly beat themselves rather than the opposition beat them. But I think Cork are too good to lose out on this one. So it's going to be a battle all the way, but I think in the last 15 minutes, I think Cork will take control of the game, and they could see it by 6 or 7 points in the end. And Pat Ryan will be absolutely delighted. You know, when you compare where they came from, you know, at the start of the year, beating Limerick, and then they sort of tripped over themselves on the way up along, and then they bounced back with two magnificent performances. So they know themselves, and to be quite honest, Marie, the whole country is talking about Cork, how good they are, and they're a team that could beat Limerick on the big day.
Mark, what do you think?
Larry, if you were in Tullamore on a Saturday night, you would be, I suppose, the confidence that's coming from my Wexford colleague there wouldn't be as strong as certainly coming out of Cork, but Cork, I suppose, when their backs have been to the wall this year, they have come out fighting. They have produced very good performances, and all we got beaten by Clare, but we did play well that night. But particularly the Limerick game was outstanding, and then the Tipperary game, whether Tip didn't turn up or not, Cork were very good on the day. Got a month off there. I suppose Pat would have been delighted to have qualified for that Liam McCarthy at that stage, but I think the performance last week against Offaly wasn't great. They will be looking for some more fight and more spirit from the team tomorrow. And obviously, if you don't get that from the team, it's going to be a slugfest, because I think there's going to be a kick in Dublin. I would have given Dublin a reasonably good chance going in against Kilkenny. They went to Galway to qualify for the Leinster final, but they just didn't show up in the day. And I know Kilkenny were really good on the day in the Leinster final, but there surely is something in this Dublin team that'll take on Cork. But if Cork Murray will turn up and play well, play the form, I think they will get over the line on this occasion.
Well, hopefully we'll get two good games of hurling anyway. Mark and Larry, thank you so much for joining me this evening. That is all we have time for. Austria have beaten Poland by 3-1. The official chart show with Blondie Tracy's up next. RTE 2FM.